From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, trying to navigate the difficult landscape of sex, power, and consent on college campuses.
Then a leading concussion doctor says his young patients today take him seriously.
I used to have to scare people, you know, say, this is a concussion, you've got to take it seriously. If you don't, you can have months of symptoms. And I have now moved to the point where I don't even bring that stuff up.
We'll meet two families in a time of transition, young adults moving from high school to college.
So I think the big difference for me will be not knowing exactly what he's doing all the time, because he'll be far away and I don't expect him to check in on an hourly basis.
And we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next after the news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Students at colleges and universities around Wisconsin and the country are generally back on campus and in class by this point in September. For freshmen, it's often their first real taste of freedom, a time when they're becoming adults and breaking free of limitations they've had growing up at home.
It's a time of experimentation for many, with alcohol, street drugs, and with sex. And for the college and university environments, the sexual landscape in the 21st century is a complex one, with a hookup culture coexisting with greater awareness of sexual assault and the importance of consent.
Writer Vanessa Gregoriadis tries to navigate these shifting waters in a new book called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke first about the place of men in this conversation, and we should note this is obviously a topic that might not be right for younger listeners.
I think it's rapidly changing, actually, the place of men in the conversation about sexual assault, particularly on campus, because there are so many guys, straight guys, guys who like to date girls, who are opening up to the reality that, you know, girls in college have a really different sexual playing field than guys do. And only by having guys as allies are we going to be able to fix the problem. You know, it's like a two-person dance. I got to do it together.
It has been a while since you were a college student, and I was a college student, to be honest. What were the biggest surprises you found when you went back, both to your alma mater, but more broadly to college campuses in general?
Yes, I went back to college campuses. I was there about 20 years after I graduated. So I figured, you know, as a mother of two, who better to explore sex on campus today other than me? And, you know, I think that the hookup culture, right, which all of us know that phrase, and sociologists think that started in the 90s. So when I was in school in Connecticut, that was beginning to be the way that college students interacted romantically. You know, hookup meaning, you know, kind of no strings. Oh, we'll just see if we both go to this party and we end up chatting, then maybe we'll go home with each other. But I don't really need anything from you and you don't need anything from me, right? And that is now really the norm on college campuses in terms of the beginning of dating. Of course, dating still happens. Of course, people still have long-term boyfriends and girlfriends. But at the beginning, there's very little of like, hey, can I bring you flowers and take you out to a movie tonight? You know, it's more like the Netflix and chill, right? That's, you know, that's a shorthand for what's going on.
Right. It seems like the whole nature of friendships has kind of changed. I mean, even people who aren't necessarily thinking of dating or were even thinking of hooking up, there seems like this sexually charged nature to friendships that a generation ago there might not have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's friends with benefits, you know, and part of friendship involves like, well, are we going to ever hook up? I mean, are we going to hook up or not? Like, because you know, there's the friendship zone, and then there's the hooking up zone, and which side are you on, and how do I categorize this person? But there's also like a lot of blurriness there of like, oh, okay, well, now we hooked up, but we can be friends after. You know, I think it's just, it's all really very vague. And that was something that I found really striking, because when you look at millennials, they're super planners, right? They want to get into a good school. They want to do well at that school. They're, you know, focused on like maybe not moving out of their mom or dad's house and getting a great job, but focused on their social media pages and how they can make them cool too. You know, and I spent a lot of time at Syracuse in the sororities, and you see these girls who really are, you know, top of the class, perfectly dressed, the sweatshirt with the Greek letters has no stains, like everything is the Google calendar, and I've got 12 extracurriculars. And then, you know, their sex lives are totally vague. And, well, I don't know, I'm going to kind of do whatever the guy wants, and maybe I'll hook up, and maybe I won't, and, you know, maybe I'll go all the way if he wants to. I said I wouldn't, but then I showed up that night and he wanted to, so I did. So there's a lot of kind of unresolved feelings, I think, around sex, particularly in this generation in college.
Well, and they're organized, and they're driven in a lot of ways, but they are still, you know, 18 to 21 year olds.
Right, right.
I mean, these are not fully formed people yet.
Yeah, they're post-adolescents, and they, you know, they don't have like they're academically, they're able to perform like adults, but emotionally they're still in a different place.
You know, so there are some people, and I gather you are one of them, that say there needs to be a way to add some nuance to the equation, that it doesn't necessarily make sense to put confused hookups in the same category as, you know, serial predators and gang rapes. And are there college campuses, as you got into it, that you saw having any success in addressing the gray areas?
Yeah, I do think a lot of college campuses that have adopted this yes means yes standard, which to a lot of adults sounds ridiculous, right? We all grew up with, if the woman does not say no, then no rape occurred, right? It is the woman's responsibility to say, I don't want to do this, push the guy away. Something, you know, really dramatic has to happen there. Or a no, a shouted no, right? And now colleges want kids to think of it in a slightly different way. They want them to ask, do you want to have sex? That is the way that they want an encounter to proceed, so that the onus is not really on the girls to say no.
Well, and you talked with a number of college-age men or boys who have been accused of sexual assault. How did you view their stories when it came to, you know, these questions of things like affirmative consent, as they call it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is that the college-age boys who are accused of assault, that, you know, largely are who then take their stories to the media, right, are largely accused of these gray zones encounters. You know, you don't get a lot of physically violent rapists coming to the media and saying, I didn't do it. But those encounters, you know, it becomes really tough, because as much as a lot of feminists would like to say, you can't reduce this to a he said, she said, well, but you actually, like, if you're looking at it like a police detective, it looks a lot like a he said, she said to the police detective, right? There's very little physical evidence. You know, usually not injuries, maybe even a string of text messages before the encounter that involve flirtation, maybe on social media, maybe on Snapchat. And so it's really tough, because you do feel for these boys. At the same time, you don't know for sure if they've done it or haven't. Really in a mystery zone there, I think, in a lot of cases.
Right. I mean, I think you quote, you know, Niels Bohr's principle of great truths, you know, that there are situations that exist in which both the accuser and the accused, like, feel honestly like they're telling the truth here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, people who study this problem really think, like, we are caught in a moment of vast transition, not only in the way women are perceived professionally or socially in terms of women being breadwinners or taking on roles outside the home. You know, on college campuses, more girls are graduating than boys, right? But we're also in this vast transition in terms of the way that sexual dynamics are, you know, happening in the bedroom. And there are boys who are kind of caught in this time of transition. And we need to be fair to them, right? We need to say, well, you know, there are some cases where the boy will say, I truly didn't assault her. And the girl will truly feel assaulted, and they could both actually be right.
What might seem like sexual exploration to some might, you know, seem like sexual assault to others.
There is a fine line. At the same time, you know, there are a lot of guys who are stepping over the line.
Sure.
Like particularly girls who are really drunk to the point of not being able to speak English. You know, if you are flirting with that girl at a party and then taking her home, like, I think college students are now pretty much coming into alignment that that doesn't make you cool. Like, you just took a girl with beer goggles home. Like, great. That was really easy, huh? You took advantage of her, you know? Whether or not she's going to go to the police and try to get you locked up for it, or go to her campus administrator and try to get you kicked out of school, and where between, you know, being very drunk and aware of what she's doing and being to the point of incapacitation, which is like, you know, blacked out, maybe certainly passed out, right? I don't know. Those are hard questions to answer. But what we do know is that the social norm around taking that girl home, you know, has really changed in terms of college guys not like high-fiving the guy the next day and saying, wow, that was awesome. You nailed that girl. Like, that's not cool anymore. I think that's a big deal. You know, changes, good changes are happening, you know, and I think we need to give them a little, you know, bit of applause for that.
Do you think colleges can address the issue of sexual politics like this without also getting into the issue of alcohol and casual drug use?
No, I don't. I really don't. Because I think a lot of the assaults that are happening, and they're always happening this time of year, September, late August, early September, between, you know, two people who don't know each other very well, who just arrived on campus. It's something like 88% of all gang rape victims on college campuses are freshmen. And like over 3/4 of them are drunk. And either the guys will try to give alcohol to the girl and get the girl drunk because, you know, that's thought it was an easier way to get laid, or he'll really be a predator and really like trying to get the girl drunk. So, you know, really targeting her, which is horrible. Or the girl will be really drunk to the point where she may kind of wander into some guy's room at 4 a.m. who lives 2 floors down from her, who she just thought was cute. And maybe she just wants to go and like giggle and, you know, make some jokes. And, you know, from his point of view, you just came into my room at 4 a.m. Like, I think I know what you want, you know? And so he may push boundaries that she doesn't want to have pushed. So a lot of this weird stuff going on at the beginning of school, and a lot of it is connected to alcohol and drug use among, you know, kids who maybe haven't used that stuff that much at home. Right. And they don't know where to stop, when to stop drinking. Right. Like, they don't know, like, 20 rum and cokes, not a good idea. Hold on, you know. So.
Well, and so would you make the point that as colleges are bringing kids in for orientation and they're talking about things like affirmative consent, they ought to also be talking about things like alcohol and drug use?
Yeah, I think they are talking about all of that, but they're talking about it separately. I think they have to discuss, like, consent is golden, and don't drink your consent away. Don't, you know, after 9 drinks, a woman has a much higher probability of being assaulted. Now, 9 drinks for a woman, for an 18-year-old girl, well, that's a lot of drinks, you know? So I think that is a really important part of talking about, okay, go out, have a couple drinks. You know, this is college. Your mommy and daddy aren't looking over your shoulder, right? You're a big girl now. We all know that. But, you know, don't go somewhere with a bunch of people you don't know and continue to drink through the whole night. When you feel yourself getting out of control, go home, you know? I think that's really important.
Do you feel like you came out of the 3 years of reporting that you did for this book with any more clarity than you had when you went into it?
Well, I think this is an incredibly complicated problem, you know, and it is based on longstanding norms of how women and men should interact, and the college campus being a place where you just meet so many fellow classmates who are really strangers during the course of a night, and you just trust all of them because you think they're your friends because they're classmates, even though you don't really know them. You know, there's so many inputs here from pop culture telling kids that they need to have sex all the time. You know, that makes them cool. So many different kinds of inputs. But what I really felt like optimistic about were the actual kids I met. Like, the kids are all right. Like, they're smart. They're articulate on the subject. They're thinking this issue through. They're like, you know, they're not like these iPhone addicted droids that we think of. And like, while they may like sit at your kitchen table looking at their phones, like, you know, when they did the interviews with me, they didn't look at their phones, and they were totally engaged and bringing in all sorts of books that they had read in school and ideas that they had gotten from different films they had seen. And, you know, This generation is going to be fine. They just, you know, need to set clear boundaries, think about, you know, what they want to do each night, and not just like leave a lot up to chance and then find themselves in risky situations that they can't get out of.
Well, Vanessa Gregoriadis, it's easy to see why this is such a charged issue, but thanks for leading us through it somewhat.
Thank you.
Vanessa Gregoriadis' book is just out. It's called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich from her home office in New York. A lot of people get confused and abused real
easy when it comes to love. As the school year begins, parents begin to worry about protecting their kids from sports-related concussions. We'll learn more when Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Back to school often means back to sports for many kids. Football, cross country, swimming, tennis, and volleyball, among others, all make their return in the fall season. And with the return of practices and games, returns the risk of injury. According to the latest numbers from the Centers for Disease Control, more than 300,000 kids 19 and younger are treated for sports-related concussions every year.
Luckily, Milwaukee is home to one of the leading research teams on concussions in youth sports. Dr. Kevin Walter is part of that team. He directs the Pediatric and Adolescent Sports Medicine Program at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin.
Dr. Walter spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello about common misconceptions around concussions and what parents can do to calm their nerves as kids take the field this fall.
So I think looking back to when I came out of training in 2004, the number of concussions definitely increased since then. Over the last few years, it's increasing at a slower rate. And I think a lot of that increase is just greater awareness. You know, it seems like you can't open a newspaper or turn on the TV without hearing so-and-so got a concussion, which is great, but it also makes people scared. You know, oh my gosh, is concussion going to turn me into these NFL players? And it won't. But I also think that some of the increase is kids are training differently. You know, middle school kids are doing things that used to be done at high school and collegiate level. So they're training better, they're bigger, stronger, faster. And there's wonderfully a lot more opportunity for kids to participate in youth sports. But when you participate in sports, there's risk of sport with injury. And so more exposure with sport equals more injuries as well.
Do you find... I don't want to throw shade at parents, but is there risk for overdiagnosis by a parent or a non-clinical person just because they're hearing about this becoming a thing, or they're seeing it on the news, they're hearing about these NFL players, because I feel like that's where we hear the most about it. Mm-hmm. Do people jump to conclusions that their kid might have a concussion a lot more quickly now?
Yeah, I think so. Again, going back to 2004 when I came out of training, I used to have to scare people, you know, say, this is a concussion. You've got to take it seriously. If you don't, you can have months of symptoms. And I have now moved to the point where I don't even bring that stuff up because people come in scared enough. And I have to kind of talk them down the ledge of, no, your child's first concussion will not cause long-term problems. It will not drop their IQ or make them dumber. It will not lead to permanent mood or behavioral changes. I expect full recovery if you do the right thing. But a lot of times somebody hits their head and now there's a headache or grades have dropped and people just try and put two and two together. Could this be concussion related? And so they jump, maybe it is, and they bring them in. And we find, you know, a handful of patients every month in our clinic that just don't appear to be concussion but are symptoms from another problem, like a headache disorder. You've got new onset migraines, but you first noticed them after soccer practice. And you thought, well, maybe I hit my head, maybe I have a concussion.
So I've never had a concussion, knock on wood, but I don't know if I could even recognize the signs for one if I thought that might be what was wrong with me. What would be the signs? What would someone come in thinking they'd have a concussion? Why?
Yeah. So signs and symptoms. The most common one that a lot of people know about is headache. You can get dizziness. You can get nausea. You can see spots and have quick vision changes. Some people experience higher degrees of symptoms than others. And then when you interact with people, they'll complain about memory loss. They'll repeat answers. They'll get confused. They'll be slower. They'll be foggier. And those are kind of the bigger symptoms of the physical side of things, headaches, nausea, et cetera. The cognitive or thinking side of things, just the slowness and fogginess. And then you can get some sleep problems. Usually those manifest a little bit later. And then you can get some mood. The way I always say, if you had a headache all day, you'd be grouchy too. But with concussion, kids just get a little more mood swingy and more emotional. But right out of the gate is usually a pretty common story of, there was a head impact, and immediately following this head impact, I got these physical / cognitive symptoms.
So we were talking about this before we turned the mics on, but who is coming into you with concussions most often? I know we said, like, just sort of living puts you at risk for this, mm-hmm. but if we're talking about kids who are student athletes, what sports are they playing? What's happening to them? Give me an idea of who's coming to see you.
So the cool thing with concussion is there's been a lot more research in epidemiology, who gets them and how many. I think the latest paper that came out said across the U.S. in pediatric and adolescent sport and recreation-related concussion, 1.1 to 1.9 million a year. So it's an astounding number.
Wow.
When you look at the sports, football is still the highest. Big collision sport. Lots of players on the field. Soccer, wrestling, ice hockey, lacrosse, rugby, field hockey is in there too. I know that's a much more regional sport. Those make up that next tier. You could argue throwing basketball in there as well. Skiing, snowboarding, skateboarding, bike riding, recreation or sporty activities, but not like high school sanctioned sports. Mm-hmm. There's a fair number in those too. And then, you know, we see it even in sports that people never would imagine. Concussion, track, swimming, you know, any sport, you can get it if you have enough bad luck.
That's true. You were talking about the number that people get. And I had a friend who had had multiple concussions and was told, you know, you get one more, you're done. Is there like a magic number that you really shouldn't let yourself get to before you take yourself out of an activity like a sport?
All right, so is there a magic number? No, but I will tell you the thing that I most commonly hear is 3. Oh my gosh, if you have 3 and you're done. And I think that trickles back to like the mid-90s. 3 was a number where if you had 3 in a season, you would be done for that season. And that number 3 just stuck around. But I don't think there's hard evidence for why 3. Why not 2? Why not 4? Nobody knows. You know, clearly 1 is too many because nobody wants 1. But what I start to think about when I treat kids with multiple concussions is What's their risk of repeat injury? Because with every concussion, that increases. Making sure that they're fully recovered. So am I worried that if they got another concussion, do they have a greater likelihood potentially of not fully recovering or having substantial academic harm or substantial prolonged recovery, months and months and months? And those are the things that I try and bring up with parents. And I think that's the tricky part with treating concussion is there's no set guideline of this is too many, this is too long, this is when you need to retire. It's a whole lot of gray.
Has a parent ever come to you and said, should I even let my kid go out for the team? It's been midseason. He's had this. Should I tell him he has to stop before the season's over? I mean, is that a – should that be a medical call or should it be a parental safety call? I don't even know how to phrase that.
Really, I think that's a both. I mean, I think as a physician, a family should be able to come in and ask me anything. And, you know, my knowledge about concussion in general is going to be more than theirs. And so when families come in and they hear a lot of bad things about football and read the news about players that have committed suicide and players that are retiring because they're worried about brain damage, it's going to strike a nerve. And my kid wants to play football. Geez, is that really the best thing for them? So I get asked that all the time, whether it's football, soccer, basketball, should I allow my child to play? Or after an injury in the middle of the season, should I let my child go back into the sport? And my approach to sport is I would rather have kids healthy and active than sitting around eating chips playing video games. I am a firm believer in youth learning life's lessons through sports. I think it's teamwork, how to win, how to lose, how to follow the rules, how to work with authority, how to become a leader of others, et cetera, stuff like that. So I strongly encourage sport participation. And I think the key thing that families need to be comfortable with is the fact that there's risk. And, you know, with football, we talk concussion. There's risk for broken bones, torn ACLs in all of these sports. But that's sport. I think they need to be comfortable with the team, meaning is the coach someone that they trust? You know, coach becomes a second parent, let's face it. And not to throw coaches under the bus, but there are definitely coaches that if you try and report an injury, they will say hide it. Even today, I hear that all the time, kind of ostracize them from the team, which is clearly not helpful or a good thing. So if as a parent you don't feel that the coach is acting appropriately or I don't know if in your child's best interest is the right way to say it, then you got to think twice about that. And then I think the other thing that makes sense for parents to do is to look into the what ifs. What if my child gets a concussion? What happens? Who evaluates them? What happens on the sideline? What is the process for removing them from play, getting through treatment, and then getting them back to play? Because all teams, whether it is 7 or 8 years old or 18 years old, should have that process in place. And so that's what I tell families is if you're comfortable with the coach, if they've got that process in place, you've done your due diligence as a parent, you've vetted that team, that organization, and if your kid wants to play, let them play.
If we just ran through some of your sort of advice for families, if you're talking to coaches and athletes themselves, you were mentioning earlier that training is a lot different nowadays. Is there a prevention tip that applies across sports, you know, for taking yourself out of play if you feel the risk is too high, or any tips you have for the people in the sport?
I think there's not necessarily prevention, but ways to reduce risk. Number one, if you have protective equipment, wear it properly. You know, we know football helmets don't prevent concussion, but if you wear them properly, they can reduce other injuries and maybe they help with concussion a little. Number two, don't lead with your head in contact sports. So if you can keep the head out of the game, then you can reduce that risk. And then I think the other one that you look at is play within the rules. I took care of a school in the past, a high school, and people will say, oh, you know, they're letting them play, they're letting them get rough, and just let them play the game and don't over-officiate. And I mean, it was bad, and I leaned over to a ref and said, hey, somebody's going to get hurt. You got to start calling this game a little tighter, please. And I was told if I talked to them again that they would penalize the team and throw me out. you know, some refs will be more responsive than that. But if you can officiate properly and teach proper technique, that gives you your best shot at reducing risk.
So better safe than sorry would be an appropriate mm-hmm. way to go with concussions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
When in doubt, hold them up.
Dr. Kevin Walter is a clinical researcher at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. He spoke with education reporter Rachel Morello.
Coming up after a break, we'll have another view of heading back to school, this time from the perspective of parents who are sending their kids off to their first year of college. Lake Effect Weekend returns with that story right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. It's back to school time, and many kids are making transitions, perhaps entering kindergarten, middle, or high school, or maybe going to a new district. But one of the biggest changes comes in that fall when a son or daughter heads off to be a college freshman.
Jesse Garcia has been documenting two families from Shorewood for the past 4 months. Each was getting ready to launch their eldest away from the nest for the first time.
You're going to meet two families right in their kitchens, the Zacks and the Shills. I first spoke to each in the days before high school graduation. They were feeling a huge mix of emotions. Here's Tom Zack. His son, Christopher, is an only child.
I'm going to miss him. It's going to be difficult for a period of time. But on the other hand, he's an adult now, and we need to let go of him, and that's going to be hard.
He's going to University of Wisconsin, and he plans to major in art.
Christopher's mother and Zack.
Kind of nostalgic and overwhelmed a little bit, too. So just that whole anticipation of everything coming up is kind of coming right at us.
As for being empty nesters?
It's a mix, because part of it's going to be very freeing. And I know I'm going to be really sad that he's not here, because he's a big part of our focal point, if you will, having an only kid. But I don't know. I think it's just going to be so many things. Could be great. I'm really just trying to think that it's time for us to have things for ourselves.
Yeah, I emailed him yesterday.
Oh, you did? Okay.
In the Shills kitchen on a sunny June day, we find Mom Kathy, son John, known as Jack, and their dog. Dad and Jack's younger sister are out. Kathy tries to imagine the changes that are coming.
It's hard to know what our house is going to be like without this person around all the time. Although I found this year, you know, as they get older, they're just not at home that much anyway. So I think the big difference for me will be not knowing exactly what he's doing all the time, because he'll be far away and I don't expect him to check in on an hourly basis.
In fact, they both agree that a once-per-week phone call with some texting in between should be fine. Jack will be at Carleton College, south of Minneapolis. He's still deciding on a major.
I think it'll be cool to, like, have a bunch of new people to meet, but at the same time, I think it's a little scary because I've had all these friends for all these years, and now it's kind of like there's nothing there, and I have to create everything new again, so it's a little scary.
Now they have graduation itself coming up.
Yeah, it's a mixture of pride and not sadness, but a little bittersweetness about the passage of time, but also the excitement of going forward. And that will all, I'm going to have Kleenex with me for sure.
And Zack after the ceremony.
That was beautiful and so meaningful, overwhelming. Lots of great emotions.
All right. So you need a little, like a laundry hamper.
Fast forward now to August. And we meet Kathy and Jack in the aisle of a big box store, shopping for dorm supplies.
I'll be moving in 3 days.
So how are you feeling moving in 3 days?
I'm kind of nervous, but I'm also excited. And like sad to be leaving Shoreward and my friends, but I'm pretty excited to see what it's like out there.
Standing by the mesh laundry baskets, Jack talks about the classes he just registered for.
I'm taking three classes. One is like a freshman seminar, which is called Measured Thinking, which uses like statistics and stuff to talk about real world situations. One is like intermediate French. And then my third class is environmental ethics. Yeah, it seemed like it was always so far in the distance, and then now all of a sudden it's here, so it's definitely really weird.
I'm excited. I think he picked a great spot. He's going to fit in well.
Are you pleased that he's going to school just in a neighboring state versus really far away, or does it matter?
I really am pleased. When he was applying to schools, you know, we wanted him to apply wherever he wanted to, and I didn't think that the distance would make that much of a difference, but I will admit that it's comforting to know he's only a 5-hour drive away.
Over at the Zach's house, Christopher is also 3 days away from moving. For now, he's hanging out in the living room, strumming his guitar.
Definitely very nervous to move, but I also like don't feel like I'm permanently leaving all this stuff, you know what I mean? Nervous having a roommate, because I've never had a roommate before. Nervous, like, the classes or just what I'm going to do with my time, I guess. But excited, like, I'm, like, going somewhere else, you know? Like, there's a lot of opportunities to do stuff. I'm taking 3 art classes and a physics class. It's a lot of anticipation more than anything, but...
And you'll miss this cat, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yes.
And Zach has been cleaning up from breakfast and joins us now in the living room.
It'll be so different for him living in a different city. You know, Madison's a lot different than Milwaukee. So for him, I think he'll feel like he's really somewhere else. For us, I think we're going to try to respect that. That's 90 minutes away, but it's not an invitation for us to be, you know, involved.
The first weekend without their son, they plan to go up north. After that,
I think we're just going to probably stay busy and we'll see. I'm going to visit my sister at the end of September. I kind of want to have things to look forward to and just have things on the agenda.
The guitar player might not be right in the living room anymore, but the Zachs and the Shills know it's time to find a new rhythm for everyone. After all, what other choice is there? Kids grow up. For Lake Effect, I'm Jessie Garcia.
We're happy to report that both kids and all parents are doing well so far. They'll see each other at Parents Weekend.
There's no combination of words I could put on the back of a postcard. No song that I could sing.
Stick around. This weekend's Ex Fabula is up next on Lake Effect Weekend, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM.
Photographs with sepia tone loving.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And that means, of course, it's time for another edition of Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined, as usual, by the fabulous Leah Delaney, co-founder of Ex Fabula. Welcome back.
Well, hello. How are you?
Doing pretty well. Good. We're straight in fall now, that's for sure.
Yeah, we really are. This is my favorite time of year, actually. It's nice and cool. It's time for a snuggly sweater.
And you have a very fetching sweater on today, actually.
Well, thank you so much.
I love the fall as well.
Yeah.
So we got some great stories lined up this week.
Yes.
Very timely stories.
Very poignant and timely for sure. Just to kind of like roll back a little bit, you know, I do want to go back into the mission of Ex Fabula. You know, we celebrate the power of true and personal stories in order to connect individuals from diverse communities who might not hear each other's stories on a daily basis. And it's our job to, you know, create that forum for people to connect in such a manner. And with the events of this past week, with the dismantling of DACA and everything of that nature, we decided to create our theme as Dreamers, because we want to highlight how very different the American dream can be from one person to another. So let's roll right into the stories today. We're going to start out today's show with a story that was originally told at Racial Justice, The Courage to Act, a conversation with Exfabula fellows. So let's listen to storyteller Michelle Streed.
The first student I want to talk about is a young woman named Arleth. And I met Arleth during my first couple of years of teaching, first as her classroom teacher, and then later on in the program as when she was a senior. Seniors spent their time at this on this campus, off campus, at Milwaukee Area Technical College, taking college-level credits to earn towards a program of their interest. So I was her on-campus staff mentor. So when she had like stumbling blocks or as she was going through the college application process and or the scholarship process, being able to do all of those big what comes next decisions, I was the point person for her. So I could talk with her and the college admissions process for a student like Arleth should be incredibly easy. It should be cake. Because Arleth made all of the right decisions when she was in high school. She worked incredibly hard to the point where on her high school graduation day, she walked away with 44 college-level credits that transferred into the university that she was going to, meaning that she'll be able to graduate in 3 years with a program that normally would take five. So she was a varsity athlete. She played varsity basketball. She was a varsity track athlete. She ran cross country before she realized that long distance running is terrible and she didn't want to do it anymore. And that's fine. She was our president of our student council, and she organized a bunch of different events for kids, including an event that recognized all of the voices in the building, a multicultural food fair, where kids were able to bring foods that were representative of their background and share that part of themselves with the school community. So here comes her senior year, and we are ready to be able to fill out all of these applications, to be able to figure out, it's not about where she's, it's about what she wants at this point, right? It's not about what is the only option available for her. Except we realized pretty quickly that the college admissions process for a student like Arleth is not going to be as easy as we would have expected, because Arleth is here as a DACA student. For those of you that don't have the background on the DACA program, what it means is Arleth's family immigrated to the States. So they came originally with a visa that then expired, and they chose to let it lapse and stay in this area. And she was under a year old when that happened. And so she is here as an illegal alien, but she has been taught in American schools, and she has been taught by American teachers, and she has really absorbed the American values that we say to kids every day when they walk into a school building. If you work hard and you do your best, then the world is your oyster, and you're going to have all kinds of opportunities available to you. But turns out, once you're done with high school, that's not actually the case. And so for a student like Arleth, filling out scholarship applications and being admitted to schools was not the problem, but being able to pay for those schools was the issue. And so we sat down in my room in December of her senior year after she was having all these admissions coming through, but she couldn't apply for federal aid because that's not for DACA students. And she couldn't apply for many of the scholarships because they have the box that says, are you an American citizen? And she couldn't check that. Things like a social security number, which is needed to even get a job to be able to earn the money that you need to. You have to go through a lot of hoops in order to do that. And she sat in my room on that December day and started crying. And she says, you know what, Michelle? I'm angry because I feel like I've been lied to by this country for my whole life. And now what do I do? America lied to me. And I had to take a pause for a second because that was really hard to hear, that not only did America lie to her, but I kind of did too. Because for the past 3 years, I told her that if she worked hard and she tried her best and she did everything that she could, that the world would be her oyster, and it's not. So fast forward to this past year at parent-teacher conferences. I sat down with a student and his family, and this is a family that immigrated from Iraq. And his father actually fought during the most recent Iraq war, and is now here with his son in our country. And one of the things that the parents that kind of gave me pause again was, God bless you, was them giving me God's blessings for doing my job and teaching their son. So you are going to, God bless you for the work that you're doing. You're going to help my son be able to get everything that he would need to so that he can be successful someday. And that gave me another pause again, because yes, I'm doing everything that I can to be able to help their son be successful. But despite any of the efforts that I'm making, will this system work for him? And will he be able to be successful in this system? Does the system allow that? Can it allow it? I don't know. Thank you.
And that was Michelle Streed telling us her dreamer's story today. Interesting to note, Michelle Streed was part of our fellowship program. And we were starting up our new fellowship program. I think you might have heard me mention it a few times that we're still accepting applications up to September 12th. And this year's fellowship theme is going to be based on race and place. So we're still encouraging people. You have up until September 12th to get your application in if you're interested in becoming an Ex Fabula Fellow this year.
That's coming up just next Tuesday, I believe. So
yeah,
a few days from now. And our next story has an extra twist to it in that it's actually going to be a bilingual story. For those who are native Spanish speakers, they'll get to enjoy this in a few different languages.
Yes. Cesar Torres told a story at our Puente Project American Dream Story Slam, which was our first ever bilingual story slam. And I believe it was the first ever nationally held. So it was a really important story slam for us to have. So let's listen to Cesar Torres's American Dream story that is now a dreamer story today.
I got a confession. I am an immigrant. Yo soy un inmigrante. Yo me siento muy orgulloso de lo que soy. I am very, very proud of what I am, because I think I'm not only just living in this country, which is a beautiful country, and I felt so welcome, and at the same time I felt so unwelcome when I came to this country. En un principio yo no me sentía muy bienvenido aquí también, pero al mismo tiempo yo no me sentía bienvenido. Son las dos caras de la moneda que uno siente cuando uno llega a este país. It's like the two faces that you see here in the United States. You feel welcome and unwelcome. Anyway, I am originally from Peru. Yo soy de Peru. Thank you. So, my story is this. I moved here when I was 23, and I came for better opportunities. Yo me mudé aquí a Estados Unidos para mejores oportunidades, mejores oportunidades de trabajo, de educación. So when I moved to the United States, the first thing I did, I had to find a job. And I remember it wasn't easy. It was kind of hard, because you have to like find like a factory job, and then you have to like find a second job, because it was just the fact that, you know, it's kind of hard to find a job when your English is kind of broken. So cuando me mudé acá a Estados Unidos, para mí fue un poco difícil porque mi inglés no era muy bueno. Entonces yo tenía que buscar un trabajo. Me busqué un trabajo en una factoría y mi segundo trabajo fue en un restaurante. Pero lo bueno de haber trabajado en un restaurante era que así yo aprendía a hablar mejor mi inglés. Because like when I started working in a restaurant, I had to speak English with people, and that was like a school for me. That's how I built up my vocabulary. So working in a restaurant, trabajando en un restaurante, me ayudó bastante a aprender mi inglés. La segunda parte de mi sueño americano fue ir a estudiar. Entonces, like my second part was like I had to go to school. So I started going to school. I had to work and I had to go to school. Yo me puse a trabajar y me puse a estudiar. Y it might sound like a cliche, but my American dream, and I am lucky about that. It's that I found jobs, and then I went to school. I I got married, I got my wife, and I got my kid. And that's part of my American dream. Like, cuando yo llegué a Estados Unidos, pues mi sueño americano era tener mi familia. Y mi familia consistía en tener un trabajo, estudiar, tener mi esposa, y ahora tengo mi hija. So that's how I fulfill my American dream. It took me like about what? Maybe like 16 years to build it. And I am so proud of what I have done. Thank you. Me tomó 16 años en construir lo que yo quería. Y me siento bastante orgulloso de lo que yo tengo. Y me siento muy feliz con lo que tengo. I really don't take for granted what I have here. I mean, you all, whoever are Americans or even just living here in the United States, you are so lucky for what you have. And it's just amazing the opportunities that we have in this country. It's such an amazing place to live. Aquí en Estados Unidos es algo, me parece que es un país extraordinario. Acá puedes construir lo que tú quieres si es que lo quieres hacer. Y muchas gracias por todo. Well, thank you so much.
And that was Cesar Torres' story.
As if it's not hard enough to get up on a stage, tell a story in front of an audience, you have to do it now in two languages. That was really impressive and great to hear his personal anecdote of how he came here and how hard he's worked to make his American dream.
Yeah, I mean, Exfabula, trying to get as many ears listening, and that's what we're doing. So it's just an excellent story for sure. I do want to double back a little bit. I want to talk about a couple of the things that are coming up because we're rolling into season 9 with Exfabula. So we're really excited. We have our first public storytelling workshop of the season coming up on September 23rd. And we're going to be working on stories that we're going to be featuring our November Story Slam theme with, which is Risking It. So that's our November Story Slam theme. But before that, in October, if you're ready to jump on stage, throw your name in the hat. We have a very first Story Slam of Season 9, and that's going to be on October 17th, Tuesday, at the Hot Water Warehouse, and the theme is What Could Go Wrong? So that'll be a fun one to listen to for sure.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great way to start off the fall. And again, it never feels like you really took a break during the summer, but it's great to know that season 9 is now officially underway. And great to have this timely theme today of dreamers and letting us reflect a little bit more on that. So thanks again for coming in, Leah. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Rachel. Have a great one.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up our show today. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. Do be sure to tune in to our weekday version of the show, which is at 10 in the morning.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered. Coming up next, it's 4 o'clock.